provoked more protests?
Well, I have to say that President Shafiq, who I understand is a baroness, she was knighted in during her time in England. But the baroness has very little time left as president of Columbia University. I don't see how she survives in office, given the enormous resistance to her of not only the students, but the faculty. And I think that the universities across America have to realize that the young people of this country do not support the constant wars that are imperial wars that our government is either participating in or funding, and that something has to change.
Well, this is a discussion that will continue as we move into graduation season. That does it for our show. To see that interview, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The time now is 2:02. It's 6:30 p.m. here on WBAI New York, and stay tuned for Left on Left with Craig Pasta-Jardula and Professor Jeremy Kazmarov coming up.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to LOL on WBAI in New York, a space where the left critiques itself and laughs out loud to keep from crying. And you can support WBAI and become an LOL buddy by clicking on our donation page at WBAI's website, WBAI.org. Welcome to LOL. I am your host, Craig Pasta-Jardula, the captain, and I am here, of course, with the professor, Jeremy Kuzmarov, who is a professor at Tulsa Community College, and he's also an author of many books, including his newest book, Warmonger, a story about the Clintons, and it's a must-read. Go check it out and go buy it today. Ladies and gentlemen, the professor is here. How you doing there, Jeremy?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent. Let's get right into it, because there's a lot of stuff going on. You know, we hear in society so much, you know, mainstream media, our government, the newspapers out there, even some of the movies we watched growing up, that Russia's bad, right? Russia's the bad guy. They're the enemy. They're the ones, you know, it's kind of like this programming that's ingrained in us to just think that no matter what's going on, they're the enemy. And they've even just made Putin such a crazy villain. And he's the newest monster behind the head of the snake in the Soviet Union. I mean, I think a lot of people don't even realize that they're not even a communist government anymore. They still think they're the old USSR. And so therefore they demonize them. And that keeps the military industrial complex nice and fat and plush because, you know, we propagate proxy wars like what we see in Ukraine right now. But it's not the real story, is it? It's not the real history that we know about it. There was once a time, Professor, no, where U.S. and Russian soldiers embraced each other.
Yeah, well, there's a long history of U.S.-Russian cooperation that they don't really teach people in school, you know, kids in school, because Russia has to be the enemy for reasons you described. And, I mean, in the 19th century, Abraham Lincoln cultivated very close relations with the Tsar of Russia, and Russia even sent, the U.S. supported Russia in the Crimean War, and Russia sent troops during the American Civil War at Lincoln's request, because Britain and France were supporting the Southern Confederacy, and this was a signal for them to back off. And then there was, you know, historic collaboration in World War II. And the U.S. provided massive lend-lease aid. And then at the end of the war, U.S. and Soviet troops embraced on the Elbe River. It's what's known as the Elbe River link-up. And this is the 79th anniversary of that this week.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more what happened at the Elbe River and where exactly it is location-wise, the year, the whole nine yards. Because I think it's important that if we can get our minds to a point where Russia is not the enemy, right, then maybe we have a shot at peace. But right now, Russia is the enemy. I mean, you even heard these squad members say, you know, we have to preserve democracy by funding a war to fight Putin. Please tell us about the Elbe River and what happened.
Sure. Well, this is a river in eastern Germany. And, you know, this is right at the end in April 1945, the end of World War II. And it should be noted Russia, sustained over 25 million casualties in World War II. And they killed some, it was Russian soldiers that killed around 70 to 80% of Axis soldiers. And General Douglas MacArthur said that, referred to Russia's accomplishment as the greatest military achievement in all of world history, because they played such a pivotal role in the defeat of Nazi Germany, the greatest evil, arguably, in world history. So there was a lot of, you know, positive feeling toward the Russians, unlike today. And then when the troops met, you know, when the Nazis were finally defeated, they met and they embraced and they had a celebration. They drank baklava and vodka together. They danced. There were Russian girls, music, and they toasted. And these are army soldiers from the different units, you know, toasted the leaders of the United States and Soviets, Stalin and Roosevelt and Truman. And they, you know, pledged a great friendship between the two peoples and a new era of peace. And this was picked up in the Army newspaper, and it was picked up in the U.S. media and presented very positively that this was going to portend a new era of history after the horrors of World War II and Nazism.
Yeah. So the U.S. Army's Conservative Stars and Stripes devoted an entire issue to link up under the headline Yanks Meet Reds. I mean, that's great there. And you can see that the article where they're hugging together. The correspondent Andy Rooney, later of 60 Minutes fame, wrote that you get a feeling of exuberance, a great new world opening up. I mean, this is it. This is the other nuclear power, right? We're coming together. We're shaking hands. Why don't you think they report on the LV meeting in schools? I mean, shouldn't school kids learn about this? I mean, it's a great piece of American history, Professor.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think one private at the time compared it to the famous Christmas truce in World War I that people may have heard of, where on Christmas Eve, all the parties in World War I decided they weren't going to fight on Christmas and they would actually have dinner together. German soldiers, British soldiers, French soldiers, American soldiers, you know, those on opposite sides. And they realized they had so much in common. So, I mean, the power that be generally, you know, there's so much money to be made in war, something, you know, they don't want that history, no. And in the American case, you know, that people really have more commonalities across nations, and usually they're conditioned and manipulated to fight each other by greedy leaders. And, you know, in the American case, yeah, the military-industrial complex required Russia as the enemy. And, you know, the Wall Street firm that profit off war, you know, they're making a killing off Ukraine. So they're the ones, you know, who own the media and push this relentless demonization of Russia and Putin. And they want you to forget that the, you know, American and Russians have a lot in common, that they came together to defeat the Nazis and they can come together again. But these powerful interests don't want that, sadly. And a lot of them control educational institutions. And there's a kind of hidden McCarthyism where, you know, professors and teachers who teach a real peace history are often, you know, attacked or driven out of their jobs.
Yeah, it's crazy, because something we should realize is that Putin really wanted to get closer to the United States at one point. He really did. He tried to work with W. You know, he tried to be open with him. It's almost like Russia wanted to join NATO at one point, you know, and it seemed like the two were linked together. It's almost as if they pushed Vladimir Putin and the Russian Federation to the position they're in right now, because that's what they really want. That's what the war machine wants, and they control our Congress, along with the big pharma and all the other big industries. But I'm going to read to you from a Russian-famed anti-Stalinist poet, Evgeny Yevtushenko. He wrote it in his poem, and this is important here. In a steelworker's home, through the great ocean, the Pacific is between us, but we will swim it. No ocean so great it cannot become an Elbe, talking about what happened on that river. Our common Elbe we must not betray. Russia and America swim closer. Do you think we can get to a point in the coming years where Yevtushenko's beautiful dream is realized?
I think we can. I think, you know, we need education. We need just, you know, development of social movements for peace. And I think the more we can spread the true history, and the more we can educate people about the real Russia, and I think bring people to Russia, you know, travel to Russia can be a very positive experience for people to see that the people are very friendly to Americans, that there's a lot of the great things about the country today. There's obviously a very rich history there, and there's so much we have in common and so much we can benefit from cooperating together. And I think a lot of people do understand that. So I think education, organizing, and that dream can be fulfilled one day, yes.
That would be awesome. And I do think that's a great idea. Get up and go over and travel to Russia. I definitely want to try the caviar over there. I haven't tried it yet. I've only had the Japanese caviar, and I'm such a foodie. I've eaten so many things. But I mean, that's what I think the beauty of food is too, to break bread with some Russian people and just come together and understand. I think Anthony Bourdain, his episode when he went to Russia with his friend, just showed you so much, you know, this character. That's who the Russian people are. You know, they're just like us. I think the majority of people out there in the whole world are decent human people. It's just that we have an empire and a ruling class that pits us against each other. But let's tell me more, Professor, because I want to know a little bit more about some of these people. Can you tell us who was Joseph Pawlowski, Pawlowski, for the audience.
Yeah, Pawlowski. Well, actually, his son, they've had some meetings to commemorate the Elbe River anniversary, and his son has been involved. Pawlowski, he was one of the soldiers. He was with the 273rd Infantry Division, and he was one of the soldiers who was part of the Elbe River link-up. And it really touched him throughout his life. It was kind of the highest moment of his life. And he devoted the rest of his life to peace activism and to campaigning against nuclear weapons. He became a cab driver in Chicago, and he would host weekly vigils. And yeah, he wrote a book about his story. And I think he's buried. His request before he died was that he be buried along the Elbe River. I think, you know, he's just an inspiring guy who, you know, tried to carry forward the message, of that link up and push for peace. So he's, a, you know, somebody who can inspire, you know, younger generations of political activists, to continue that quest for peace, for abolishing nuclear weapons, and for a new cooperative relationship to be born between the U.S. and Russia when, you know, the Ukraine war ends, hopefully very soon.
So I did learn about this other one, and that's great. I'd like to learn more about Joe Pawlowski. I think it's really important that those people speak up from what they experience and share those moments. Maybe people can get a sense of what's really going on and understand that they're not our enemy. Lieutenant Bill Shank of the 104th Timberwolf Infantry Division compared the spirit of prevailing brotherhood to the famous Christmas truth in World War I, and I've heard about that before. Professor, can you tell us what the latter was and how the two events, the Elbe River link up and the Christmas truth, were similar?
Yeah, these seem to be, you know, moments in history that show the true human nature, that, you know, we're not put on this earth to kill one another, to hate people just because they grew up in another country, that really we've been conditioned, you know, by our media, by our educational institutions, by our politicians, including these supposedly left-wing ones who adopt the same rhetoric as the right. But really, you know, we have so much in common, and I think it's part of human nature to enjoy travel and engagement with other people from other countries, and to see how much we have in common, and to enjoy our company and to learn from each other and our different backgrounds. And that's what soldiers in World War I experienced. You know, they were doing this horrific fighting and World War I, and that's kind of what we see going on in eastern Ukraine. It's a return to this brutal trench warfare where it's basically a hell on earth. But, you know, in the case of World War I, for one day they declared a Christmas truce that they were going to – the German, the British, the French, and I think the American were involved as well, and the Russians, that they were just going to have a meal together and stop fighting. And there have been stories written about this, and some forged friendships. Like I read a story about a British soldier, and he forged a friendship from that night with a German, and they actually corresponded after the war ended. And years later, they had a reunion, and they embraced, you know, like 40 years after World War I, and they had been pen pals for all these years. So a great friendship was born. And I think that's, you know, real humanity and not fighting and killing on behalf of billionaires who just want to make more money and loot resources of countries.
I love when you throw those little points in there too as well. All right, let's talk about Henry Wallace, because I think a lot of people don't understand too as well the Elbe River link up, because it was the Russians' idea, right? They were the ones who were instigating peace here. They said, come in, we're going to leave these barracks, you're going to occupy our barracks, we're going to pull back. And for them to meet in East Germany, you know, a lot of Russian people must have felt the kind of, especially the soldiers, must have felt the feeling that, hey, man, we're going to end this. We're going to put our hand out and say, let's get some peace going here. So that it meant so much, that river. But tell us about Henry Wallace and how he relates to the Elbe River hookup, link up.
Yeah, and I think this is, you know, we're criticizing the left on this show, and I think we want to point to what the left could be in America. And America's had some good leftists, just good people in politics at high level like Henry Wallace that could be a model for political figures today. And Wallace, he would not, you know, they attacked him as a communist. He was not a communist, but he was a progressive New Dealer, and he favored cooperation with the Russians. He traveled he was an anti-fascist. He supported U.S.-Soviet cooperation against the Nazis. He traveled to Russia several times in World War II. He had a very positive impression of the Russian people. He saw they wanted peace after the war ended. They had been devastated by World War II. He wrote a book about it, and he was promoting cooperation. You know, he was president of the Yalta Agreement, was signed by the Roosevelt administration, a sphere of influence agreement that ceded Eastern Europe to, you know, Soviet influence, and Soviets agreed not to interfere in Western Europe or anywhere else. But it was generally a spirit of cooperation, and he was hoping to carry that forward. He was Roosevelt's vice president, and he was poised to be renominated as vice president in 1944 when Roosevelt was ailing, so the vice president would be the next president. But there was basically a coup in the Democratic Party against him. The lights went out at the Chicago convention, and some power brokers in the party maneuvered so that Truman came in and started the Cold War when Wallace wanted to promote the Elbe spirit and have a new era of peace.
It's crazy because we often talk about how the left used to be at one point, how it used to be peaceful and whatnot. And you just explained how he never became president. There were coups, you know, obviously when it came, Democratic coups, when it came to Wallace with Truman, we had the whole situation after Lyndon Johnson stepped down too as well. Right. You know, and then we had the whole Bernie Sanders situation. It's like the Democratic establishment will never let a grassroots true leftist come forward and they'll fight it every time. That doesn't mean we should stop. You know, but that's why we're at where we're here today, where every single member of the Democratic Party and the House voted to fund a war with Ukraine that's lost its sovereignty. It's pretty much an American puppet versus Russia and increasing NATO. It's sad. So Wallace never became president, and that's a shame that he never did. Talk about Clark Clifford. He wrote to Harry Truman during the 1948 election. He said, every effort must be made to identify and isolate Wallace in the public mind with the communist. Just, I know you talked about the fact is that they kind of framed him as a communist and stuff like that. But can you just get a little bit more in depth and tell us more about Clark Clifford and a strategy against Wallace and to link it to McCarthyism? Further, how did Clifford foreshadow the corrupt bosses of the Democratic Party today?
Very good. Yeah. And this is important history that we do see repeating itself. Anytime more progressive figures emerge, we see Democratic Party power brokers move to crush them politically, basically. And this was a key moment. You know, Clifford was this lawyer. He was later served as a defense secretary under Lyndon Johnson. He was a wealthy Washington lawyer. Defense Secretary under Lyndon Johnson. He was later a founder of the BCCI, which was a CIA money laundering bank, and he got wrapped up in that scandal. So he's a very corrupt guy, and they basically engineered to destroy Wallace, And that was a strategy. Yeah, this memo was uncovered that it was his blueprint that they had to constantly attack Wallace as a communist, even though he was not a communist. He promoted free trade and private enterprise, although he was willing to cooperate with communists in the United States as well as in the Soviet Union. But that doesn't make him somebody who wanted to institute a Marxist-Leninist system in the United States. But that's how he was attacked. And it was relentless, just like the anti-Putin, you know, propaganda we have today. And this was the beginning of McCarthyism, because a lot of Wallace's supporters faced stigmatization, and some were even beat. You know, they lost their job. They were ridiculed as communists or pro-communists. They lost their jobs. Some were even subjected to vigilante attacks and violence, and the police wouldn't protect them. And Wallace faded. You know, he was the vice president under Roosevelt. He had the majority support at that 44 convention to be renominated. Truman had tiny support, but this coup was orchestrated against him. He became the Commerce Secretary. He was giving speeches because he was calling for a new century of the common man to empower the working class, and that the age of empires is over. He wanted to close down all U.S. air bases. He wanted to end nuclear weapons, use atomic energy purely for peaceful means. But he was attacked relentlessly. He tried to run as an independent in the 48 election. He had support of Woody Guthrie and Paul Robeson and all these folk singers, but the attacks marginalized him. He only got about 1 or 2% of the vote, and then he faded politically, unfortunately. But he did inspire figures in the Democratic Party, the more progressive wing, genuinely progressive, like George McGovern, who got the Democratic Party nomination in 1972, had supported Wallace in 48 and had been a pacifist after serving as a World War II bombardier. So there are these progressive pacifist elements that have functioned in the Democratic Party before. But yeah, today, as we've been discussing, they're few and far between.
What do you think it would have been like had he become stayed the vice president, maybe become the president? I mean, you know, I know a lot of people thought that if Bernie Sanders ever became president, things would look very different, even though he was kind of like the compromise candidate for a lot of us leftists, true leftists, that is. You know, we weren't crazy about all his foreign policy decisions, especially Kosovo, right? But however, totally different as far as the mindset from the neocons that are in office today. How do you think things would have been different had Wallace stayed the vice president and then eventually became president? Would things be different? Would there ever been a Cold War?
It's very possible there wouldn't. I mean, perhaps they would have tried, if he got in, these powerful interests could have tried to sabotage his presidency. But if he was able to institute his agenda and use the bully pulpit to really spread his message, and I think many Americans would have embraced it. It was a benefit to Americans and people around the world. And I think there would have been, the Elbe spirit would have prevailed. There would have been no Cold War. And there was really no reason for the Cold War. The Soviet Union had been decimated in World War II. It was no way going to start World War III. And, you know, it was the population wanted peace with the United States. So, you know, I think, it would have been a better world. There would have been no Vietnam War. I mean, a lot of the horrific events of the Cold War resulted, you know, from these proxy war and this extreme anti-communist foreign policy that developed. And, you know, the Korea wouldn't be divided today. Korea would be a unified country, and millions of lives would have been saved. You know, the Korean War was a horror before Vietnam. 1/10 of the North Korean population was killed. The U.S. bombed North Korea nearly back to the Stone Age and wreaked massive devastation there. And that foreshadowed, you know, Vietnam was this horrific war with 3 million Vietnamese killed, 58,000 Americans killed. 10 million Vietnamese displaced. A lot of their environment was destroyed with Agent Orange and a forest destruction and defoliation program. So, and that war, you know, extended to Laos and Cambodia, and around a ripple effect with the Cambodian genocide. So we're talking about millions and millions of lives that would have been saved if Wallace and his vision had triumphed, and just a better world would have come about.
Yeah. Linus Pauling, we have up on the screen. Can you kind of connect the dots on what, how he comes into play when it comes to talking about everything you just talked about right now? And it's kind of crazy too, Jeremy, because like what we're doing in the Middle East, we did once in Asia, right? Like Korea that spun way out of control in that whole region. Now we're in the Middle East doing the same thing over and over again. It's like history repeats itself.
And that's one thing Wallace had warned about, the self-destructive effects of empire. And we're seeing the blowback and those terrible consequences today, even with the mass shootings and in many ways the implosion of our society. So, from the vantage point of today, Wallace looks even better. And Linus Pauling was a Nobel Prize winning scientist and a brilliant man. And, you know, he was looking back because he had been a Wallace supporter. And he was just looking back around the time of the Vietnam War and said, we could have prevented Vietnam. And if only Wallace had prevailed, all these terrible things wouldn't have happened. I mean, McCarthyism wouldn't have spread like it did. And that wiped out the left-wing movement in America. We're still dealing with the ripple effects of that. I mean, McCarthyism really is the root of the vast right-wing shift in American politics and the dreadful situation we're in today. And that's, I think, one of the things Pauling pointed out, that we'd have no Vietnam War, we'd have no McCarthyism, all the dictatorship that the United States propped up in the Cold War, the rise of Islamic terrorism, the support for the Mujahideen to break the evil empire as far as the Brzezinski strategy. We probably would have none of that, and that led to the war on terror. So
it's terrible because right now, if you were saying who do you compare in the Democratic Party to Wallace, you don't really have many people. I mean, the most anti-war person in Congress, probably Thomas Massie, who's a Republican, libertarian roots. But, you know, Rand Paul doesn't want to get involved in a lot of this over here. They're libertarian values, but nobody in the Democratic Party. That's it for today. If you like this, ladies and gentlemen, go to Pasta2Go's YouTube to check out more. But, of course, we're on all the great radio stations. I am your host, Craig Pasta-Jardula, the captain with the professor, Jeremy Kuzmarov. We'll see you later. You're listening to LOL right here on listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI, New York, New York, streaming at WBAI.org.
This is the mic check for Cat Radio Cafe.
Testing. Tune into Cat Radio Cafe Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
I'm Janet Coleman.
I'm David Dozer.
Displaced Playwright on Tuesday, April 23rd at 9 p.m. will be joined by the esteemed Peabody Award-winning filmmaker and producer Hilla Medaglia to discuss her new documentary, Mourning in Lud, which follows the fates of three families, Israeli, Palestinian, and Christian, intertwined through a cycle of senseless violence in the mixed Arab-Israeli city of Lud, Israel.
Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Hey, the cats drink coffee.
The cats of Brazil.
Oh, there's an awful lot of coffee in Brazil.
That's right.
This is Baby K.
And this is DJ Kyle McNeil.
Of The Sweet Spot. And we are so excited to announce our brand new time slot, Tuesday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight.
Sangre Soulful Sounds, old and new.
Brand new day, Tuesdays at 10 p.m.
Only on WBAI 99.5 FM.
New York's Pacifica Radio.
Sweet Tuesday.
On Wednesday, April 24, 2024, veteran Black Panther, distinguished author, award-winning radio journalist, and U.S.-held political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal of Philadelphia turned 70 years old in his 42nd year in prison. The Free Mumia Abu-Jamal Coalition plans to be in Philadelphia to demand his release, marking 70 years of resistance in the city of so-called brotherly love, Philadelphia. For bus tickets and details, go to freemumia.com. That's freemumia.com or call our hotline, 212-330-8029. That's 212-330-8029. When we fight, we win. Release all political prisoners.
And the previous program was Left on Left with Craig Pasta-Jardula and Professor Jeremy Kuzmarov. And that is heard on Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. here on WBAI in New York. Coming up will be a report from the WBAI local station board. The first report of 2024 from the WBAI local station board, presented by some of the WBAI LSB officers and some of the PMB directors. Listener calls will be taken at 212-209-2877 during that hour, when they will tell you. And I guess with all that said, we can start this program. It is almost 7 p.m. Stay tuned for a report from the WBAI LSB coming up.
WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. Streaming at www.wbai.org.